This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. If you refuse to give your name to a police officer, you could get arrested. Earlier this week, the Supreme Court upheld a Nevada law that makes it a crime to refuse to tell the police your name if you're stopped for suspicious behavior. There are similar laws in 20 other states. In a few minutes, we'll hear two views on this decision, one from law enforcement, the other from a privacy rights perspective. And we also want to hear from you. Is it common sense that police ought to be able to ask for names as they investigate suspicious circumstances, or is this the criminalization of silence? How does it affect Miranda rights, the right to remain silent, and how far does it go? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Nina Totenberg, NPR legal affairs correspondent, joins us here in Studio 3A to tell us about the case that led to Monday's Supreme Court ruling. Hi, Nina.
Hi, Neil.
A man in Nevada, Larry Dudley Heibel, was stopped. His pickup truck was on the road. He was in an argument. Somebody called in a complaint. Tell us what happened.
Well, he was standing on the side of the road with his car, smoking a cigarette, leaning into the passenger side window, talking to his 19-year-old daughter when a police car pulled up. The police had gotten a phone tip that there had been some sort of domestic dispute going on inside this truck, that they'd seen a man slug a woman in a truck that matched this description. So he pulls up, and he asks Mr. Heibel to identify himself. And Heibel says, why? And he says, because I'm conducting an investigation. We had a report of a fight. And Heibel says, I didn't do anything wrong. I'm just pulled over here on the side of the road. Now, this is all captured on videotape on a camera that's mounted on the patrol car, as I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
The audio isn't very, very clear. Otherwise, I suppose we might play it for you. But it's clear enough so that if you work at it, you can hear it. And it's clear that Heibel thinks he's being stopped because he's somehow illegally parked. And he says, I'm parked correctly. And the policeman keeps saying, I'm conducting an investigation. Show me some sort of ID. Identify yourself. 11 times he asks this. He later said that he thought that Mr. Heibel, to put it rather bluntly, looked mm-hmm. drunk. Mr. Heibel refused. And he basically started taunting the policeman. He said, look, if you think I've done something wrong, he puts his hands behind his back. He says, cuff me, take me off. So finally the cop does just that, takes him off. And in Nevada, there's a law that makes it a crime to refuse to identify yourself in a suspicious circumstance, in any circumstance that a policeman deems suspicious. So the punishment is up to 6 months in prison. He was fined $250. Mr. Heibel, who's a cattle rancher and insisted on his right to be let alone, took his case all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And yesterday, the Supreme Court, or is it Monday?
Monday,
the Supreme Court said by a 5-4 vote that he didn't have the right to withhold his identity unless that identity actually provided evidence of a crime, and the court said that it wasn't deciding that question, but that in most circumstances, as Justice Kennedy said, writing for the majority, in the greater scheme of things, providing your name is no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
It serves important law enforcement purposes. It might tell the policeman whether you have a violent history, whether there's a repeated instances of domestic dispute, that kind of thing. And so this is a perfectly reasonable thing for somebody to have to provide.
The vote was 5-4. What was in the dissenters' opinions?
Well, Justice Stevens, writing in dissent, said, well, if it's no big deal, then why are you making him provide it? And that there is a right to be let alone. And three other members of the court said, look, we've had a rule here since 1968, and that rule says that police can briefly stop and detain somebody for questioning, but the court has always suggested that you don't have to answer the questions. The police have the right to ask them, but you don't have to answer the questions. And on Monday, Justice Kennedy and the majority said, well, we don't consider that controlling anymore. We think you have to answer the question about your identity.
Mm-hmm. Those of us who are not lawyers sit back and say, wait a minute, the first thing you're supposed to happen to you when you're arrested is you read your Miranda rights, which says you have a right to remain silent.
Well, he hadn't been arrested yet, even. And I suppose you have the right to remain silent, but the idea is that your name doesn't provide evidence of a crime that can be used against you. And if it does provide an important link to a crime, the court said, well, we'll take that up later. We're not going to decide now whether you have to provide your name if, in fact, providing the name does provide evidence of a crime.
Now, what are the ramifications of this? I mean, some people are concerned that other states, as we mentioned, I think 20 already have such laws. Other states or even the federal government might adopt this law.
Well, I would assume that they would, especially in a time of terrorism, when everybody wants to have some way of knowing pretty quickly who somebody is and what they're doing, where they are. So I would assume that more states will pass such laws. The court wrote a pretty narrow opinion, though. It didn't say you have to show a government ID, even. It said you have to give your name. That's all it said. And that leaves a lot of latitude still in terms of what could be required. And there are lots of these state laws that require much more than just your name. They may require production of a driver's license or even more stuff, an explanation of why you are where you are. None of that has been tested.
Now, did the majority, I know some of the dissenters raised the question of, you know, hey, in this day and age, that police officer, once he has your name, can go back to his car and type in your name and get a lot of information on you from either legal law enforcement databases or from the World Wide Web, for that matter. Did that come up? Did the people in the majority answer that question at all?
Not really. That was certainly in the briefs in the case. But the court majority seemed to think that possibility was overblown in view of the fact that all that was at issue here was actually providing your name, and that if, for example, that name provided an important link to connect you to a crime, that you might be able to challenge that as having violated your Fifth Amendment right to remain silent.
Mm-hmm. This is an email question we got from Michael in Portland, Oregon. I'm trying to follow the Fifth Amendment logic in this decision. The court seems to be saying that under a Terry stop, which is that 1968 ruling you mentioned just before, under a Terry stop, an officer can require reliable identification on of the subject of the stop unless providing information would lead to self-incrimination. Doesn't then the refusal itself to provide identification constitute de facto self-incrimination? And wouldn't that would that refusal not also give the officer every incentive to violate that right?
Well, I suppose he should have been in the Supreme Court arguing the case. I got to tell you the truth. I think that the court, in all likelihood, if this case had come up pre-9/11, might have decided it a different way. But having said that, the justices in the majority went to great lengths to write this about as narrowly as they possibly could, so that while there is great fear that this decision will be used as fodder, for example, to justify a national identity card system and things like that, and certainly you could make the argument that it does, it provides the minimal support for that. If the court was going to do what it did, it couldn't have written, I don't think, a much more narrow opinion.
Again, are there 20 other states that have such laws?
20 all. Yeah, I think that's right. 20 altogether.
Okay. Nina, thanks very much. I know we're expecting several more important decisions from the Supreme Court over the next week or so as they wrap up this term. So I hope we'll be hearing more from you in the next 10 days or so. The court session ends, what, the end of the month?
It should end by the end of the month.
Okay. Thanks. NPR's Nina Totenberg, our legal affairs correspondent here with us in Studio 3A. Joining us now from his office here in Washington is Bill Johnson, Executive Director and Legal Counsel for the National Association of Police Organizations, and it's very good of you to join us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Your organization filed an amicus, a friend of the court brief in this case, supporting the Nevada state law, so I imagine you're pleased with the court's decision. Tell us about that.
Yes, we did file an amicus brief in the case, and we were pleased with the court's decision in this. If anything, honestly, I think we're a little surprised that it was a 5-4 decision. I think we're expecting the margin of victory to be a little bit wider than that. But I think in reading what the court actually wrote, I don't think it's a surprising decision. I don't think that the court has broken any new ground here. I think at most, in our view, the court has clarified some Fourth Amendment principles that will help guide police and citizens in the context of an admittedly legal Terry stop.
And the Terry stop again, that like Miranda decision, it's the Terry comes from that 1968 case that the Supreme Court decided.
Right, the 1968 case called Terry versus Ohio, which basically said that police officers, when they don't have enough probable cause to make a full-blown arrest of someone, the court is going to say, we will still allow police officers, when they have a reasonable and articulable suspicion that criminal activity is afoot, we'll allow officers to momentarily or briefly stop citizens and ask them questions. If there's a belief that danger is there, they may do a limited pat-down search for weapons. But basically, to preserve the status quo while the officer gathers more information to try to either learn that, yes, criminal activity is afoot, or no, there's a perfectly innocent and reasonable explanation for what he or she saw.
Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. David is on the line with us from Concord, North Carolina.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Is this not a violation of the Fourth Amendment?
On search and seizure?
Well, you are safe in your persons. Does that not mean that you're safe to walk down the street without the King's agents or police harassing you?
Bill Johnson?
I think the court's decision makes clear that they are analyzing what happened in this case under the Fourth Amendment. And Mr. Heibel wasn't just walking down the street. The court does take care to point out that a citizen had called into the sheriff's department to report an assault of a woman in a GMC pickup truck at a certain location. And that when the sheriff's deputy arrived there, he saw that pickup truck on that street with a woman in the front seat, with a man who appeared to be intoxicated near her, and skid marks leading up to the truck, which indicated the officer that there had been some sort of swift stopping or movement of that vehicle, all of which together, the court says, was allowable, or which gave the officer permission under the Fourth Amendment to at least investigate further under Terry versus Ohio to try to see what was going on to try to resolve this.
So, again, under that Terry ruling that came out so many years before, there has to be some grounds for the police officer to initiate his investigation.
Correct. And this case doesn't change any of that. This case assumes that under the facts as they were presented, the officer already was legitimately in contact with Mr. Heibel under the Fourth Amendment. So none of that has changed. The protections that the Fourth Amendment provide are still there, and the guidelines that the court has provided for police officers are still in place.
The same guidelines that existed before this decision?
Yes, sir, I think so.
Okay.
It just seems to me like as long as it's conservative rulings, also a conservative majority, that, you know, each state had to ratify the Constitution, and that means the Bill of Rights also. And some states didn't want certain clauses in there. And I think people need to take a real hard look at the Fourth Amendment, and especially the Patriot Act. There's a lot of violations.
Okay, David, thanks very much.
Okay.
Let's go now to Eric, and Eric's with us from Oakland. And Eric, I've made a terrible mistake. I've put you on the air, but we only have a few seconds left in this segment. So can I put you on hold, and we'll get back to you when we come back from the break?
Yeah.
Okay, Eric. Thanks very much. We appreciate it. We're talking about this week's Supreme Court decision that people may not withhold their identity from police under suspicious circumstances. And when we come back from the break, we'll take Eric's call and more of yours. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, TOTN at NPR.org. Our guest right now is Bill Johnson of the National Association of Police Organizations. Later in the program, we'll be speaking with Mark Rotenberg, the president of Electronics Privacy Information Center. He'll be joining the conversation. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing this week's ruling by the Supreme Court that allows police to arrest people who refuse to give their names under some circumstances. If you have questions about the decision, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Our guest is Bill Johnson of the National Association of Police Organizations. And Eric now joins us on the phone from Oakland, California. Thanks for your patience, Eric.
Yeah, hi. Well, I just have a trouble with this idea that there's a suspicious behavior that is somehow known to all. I live in Oakland. I'm white person, and I could be accosted for being white in a black, primarily black neighborhood, and I have, as a matter of fact. And I just have a problem giving more power to an unenlightened, morally self-righteous officer of the peace when I might be, you know, just as equal under the Constitution, but yet he is more equal in the courts.
Well, Bill Johnson, a lot of people are suspicious of the police's suspicions.
Well, I think that's one of the things that this case stands for. In this case, Mr. Heibel obviously thought at the start that the officer didn't have the right to ask him his name. And this case indicates that a case like that can literally go all the way to the Supreme Court to be resolved.
Mm-hmm.
The court in this case has held that it is not unconstitutional for an officer in the type of circumstances that existed in this case, not a case where someone was merely walking down the street or was of a different color than people around him, but in a case where a potential crime had already been reported to the sheriff's office, that it was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment to inquire further about what was going on, and that part of that, the court calls it a common sense inquiry, part of that inquiry is to ask the identity of the people we're dealing with. And the court really went no further than that in that case.
Eric?
I've had run-ins with many police officers who I could make a good argument that didn't have much common sense. And to say that it's articulable, a lot of them have a hard time articulating any of their thoughts.
Did they ask you your name, Eric?
Well, yeah, they wanted to know my name, where I'm from, what are we doing, what am I doing in this high-crime neighborhood? I mean, I happen to live in a higher-crime neighborhood because that's what I can afford in the Bay Area. And I don't see why, you know, being suspicious is just being someone who they think looks out of place. I mean, that's their articulation of it.
Bill Johnson, Eric seems to be talking about, in some ways, excuse me if I'm putting words in your mouth, Eric, but it's a little bit about profiling, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's a concern that a lot of people have about the police and whether this ruling gives the police more power in that respect, Mr. Johnson.
Well, I don't think it does, and the reason why I say that is that I think the court took great care in its majority opinion. The very first thing they did was lay out the circumstances that caused the deputy sheriff in this case to come into contact with Mr. Heibel in the first place. And they seem to take great care in pointing out that this was a report of a serious crime, of an assault on someone, that there was a specific location given, there was a specific vehicle description given, that an officer quickly responded to that scene,
yeah,
found a matching vehicle at the matching location.
As you've told us before. Okay.
Or that's a white Ford pickup. I mean, you know, anybody has that.
Well, a specific location, a man and a woman, it does seem to jibe, at least in that respect, Eric, but it didn't seem to be hassling somebody for no particular reason. Anyway, we're going to give another person a call. Thanks.
Thanks.
All right. It's an email question that we have from Ryan. As to your current conversation, give name, proof of name, can one withhold your Social Security number?
That's a good question, and I think that will become questions like that and cases like that will arise more frequently in the future. But this particular case really doesn't address that issue.
Mm-hmm.
The court, in its majority opinion, seems to focus really on the Fourth Amendment implications of what happened and seems to decide that in this type of circumstance, that learning the identity of the person with whom we're dealing is not unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment. The particular statute in Nevada, the court says, has been interpreted to require disclosing one's name and nothing else. And the court does take pain in noting that. But further questions as to Social Security number, for example, or addresses and phone numbers, things of this nature, are honestly just not addressed in the particular opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Although the court does note that it has previously held that it is proper for officers to see someone to take fingerprints, for example, or blood sample, or handwriting exemplar, all in an attempt to further investigate or further establish the identity of the person with whom we're dealing. So while Social Security numbers, because of you know, the vast number of uses to which they've been put over the last years, are a matter of increasing concern. That particular issue has not yet been addressed by the court, at least in this opinion.
And another email question, this one from Andrea Croskery in Greenville, North Carolina. What's to keep you from giving your name as Bob Jones, John Smith, or John Doe, for that matter?
Well, I think the underlying assumption in the court's case is that when the Nevada statute requires someone to give their name or to identify themselves to the police officer, the underlying assumption is that that name will be true. In fact, the actual statute that Mr. Heibel was convicted under is a statute that makes it a misdemeanor to obstruct an officer in the investigation or the performance of his or her duty.
So obstruction of justice is this.
So I think it would be fair to say that giving a false name with the intent to mislead the officer would be just as much a violation as Mr. Heibel did in not giving his name at all. In either case, you've refused to identify yourself, and the court has said that states are free to penalize that.
And just to follow up on the last point that Nina Totenberg was talking about, do you see this as a predicate for the an attempt to establish a national identity card?
I don't think so. And the reason why I say that is even if the Supreme Court would say that, and I'm not saying they would, but even if the Supreme Court said that such a card would not violate the Fourth Amendment, I think politically Congress simply would not be able to institute such a law, even after September 11th. I think politically the concerns would be so great that such legislation simply wouldn't pass in the United States today.
Bill Johnson, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Bill Johnson, Executive Director and Legal Counsel for the National Association of Police Organizations. He joined us on the phone from his office here in Washington. With another view, we're joined now by Mark Rotenberg. He's President of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, also here in Washington, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil.
Your organization also filed an amicus, a friend of the court brief. Yours was, though, in support of Mr. Heibel, not the state of Nevada. This must be a disappointment.
Well, we were disappointed. We felt that Mr. Heibel had strong constitutional claims, both on the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, but we were also particularly concerned in the 21st century what the implications might be of disclosing your name to a police officer who would likely have access to many government databases. And so we argued in our friend of the court brief that basically this is not your father's Terry stop. This is an opportunity for the police to learn an awful lot more about a person than they would have known back in the 1960s when the court created the Terry doctrine.
So that this is, in effect, a vast extension of power once you include all of that computing power you're talking about.
Well, we believe that's right. Now, it's interesting, in fact, we think the court largely avoided the issue. In fact, Justice Kennedy, in his opinion for the court, was very careful to say that the statute could be satisfied merely by speaking one's name and you could not be required, for example, to produce an identity document or a driver's license. I think he really was trying to steer away from this concern. Justice Stevens, in dissent, was more direct when he said there's a problem here, and the problem is, in fact, that law enforcement will have access to these databases.
All right, let's get another caller in. Tom is on the line with us from La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Yes, Neil, thank you very much.
Sure.
Last summer, I applied for a job. You went through the usual things, background checks, stuff like that. Anyway, 10 weeks later, they came up and said that I had a felony arrest record going back to 1981 when I got out of college. I've never been in Chicago, never had a felony arrest. I was interested in what Nita told me, because I carried the documents from the Illinois State Police that exonerated me through photographs and handprints.
So you suspect basically somebody else with your name was convicted of a felony?
It was listed as Tony E. Stapleton. And I carry these documents, and I was intrigued by her comment that I should just shut up and say, I may give you information that could link me to a felony. Even though
it wasn't your felony. And well,
no, not at all. And let's say, I've got these documents in my briefcase right now as I'm traveling on I-90 towards La Crosse.
Well,
I keep them at all times.
Drive safely, first thing. But Mark Rotenberg, isn't this one of the one of the things that you were warning against?
Well, it is, in fact, and we raised that issue in our brief. We pointed to the fact that there are errors in many of these government databases, and one of the unfortunate
well.
since 9/11 is that the FBI has taken the... Hello?
Yeah, Tom's cell phone is going wacky on us. I'm going to have to hang up on him. Go ahead.
Well, we said in our brief that post 9/11, the FBI had taken the position that it no longer needed to maintain record accuracy under the Privacy Act, basically avoiding the obligation that existed prior to 9/11 to make sure that the information that they were relying on was accurate and timely. And we said, of course, you know, law enforcement access to these databases coupled with the increasing inaccuracy could lead to more problems in these kinds of stops.
Mm-hmm.
So we think it is a legitimate concern. Again, it's not an issue that the court ended up addressing directly in this case. There's another case going back a few years ago, I think Arizona versus Evans, where the court did look at the question of whether or not the police could make an arrest based on information from a computer database that turned out to be incorrect.
I guess it's kind of a legal conundrum because the ruling in this case says you have the right not to implicate yourself, but if it wasn't Tom's own conviction, is he implicating, it gets pretty complicated as to whether he has a right. He could show him the papers that he keeps in the trunk of his car anyway. Let's get another caller on the line. Sophia is with us in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I'm a teacher. I teach in middle school, and the basic thing you teach kids is if the teacher stops you and asks you a name, you give her the name. And most of the time, the kids who are really in trouble or don't want to get in trouble, they would refuse to give the name. And I'm just calling to say, what's wrong with giving the name? There is nothing wrong with it. If you are not in trouble, or even if you are in trouble, you should give your name.
Well, I think certainly we have a long constitutional history in this country of not allowing the police to compel people to say and do things that might lead to incrimination, to an arrest, to conviction. And we do that out of recognition, of course, that in the context of one of these types of police stops, there's an enormous coercive authority that can lead to real abuse. That's, for example, why the court announced the rule in the Miranda case, basically telling a person who was under arrest very clearly and very directly what the rights were. And the first right, of course, is that you have the right to remain silent. It's, I think, part of a very proud tradition that this country has. And part of the unease surrounding this case is the sense that there's been a chipping away against that principle of not being required to incriminate yourself. It seems very modest that you would only say your name and nothing else. But before the court's decision this week, in fact, you could not be compelled to give your name in a police stop that was less than an arrest.
But what about Sophia's point that if you haven't done anything wrong, what's the big deal? And again, that's what the majority in the court ruled. What's the big deal?
Well, of course, you ask the question, why is the name being asked? I mean, what's the purpose? If you're investigating the crime, as the lieutenant was in this case, of, you know, whatever the circumstances may have been concerning Larry Heibel on the street,
mm-hmm.
You really have to ask the question, you know, why should a person be forced to say their name if the police officer doesn't have reason to arrest the person based on the facts that he's been able to identify? And once you open the door and you say, in effect, okay, under this state law, if you don't give your name, you can be arrested, and under the next state law, if you don't give your name and some other information, you can be arrested, where do you draw a line? Now, to the extent that the people who sided with Larry Heibel in this case take some solace this week, it is because the court, we feel, drew the line just as narrowly as it could and said basically name only. But they've opened a door, and I think it's unfortunate.
Hmm. Sophia, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's a question in from Bill, who's on the line with us from Salem, Oregon.
Yes.
Hi.
Good afternoon. I have a question. I'm not clear under what are there any situations in which you don't have to give your name? And if so, what are they? And under what situations do you have to divulge your name?
Well, I think it's important to understand in this case that when Larry Heibel made the decision not to give his name, he was facing arrest under a state law that exists in Nevada and approximately 20 other states. So this act of disclosing your name is not something that, you know, you voluntarily choose in states that have such statutes. You are being compelled to give your name or else you face arrest. That's why the case was before the Supreme Court. Now, the court has recognized a narrow set of circumstances where you can be compelled to identify yourself. Obviously, one is post-arrest, and if the police have probable cause to arrest you, then in the process of booking, they will certainly get your name. But pre-arrest, to be charged, in effect, for not disclosing your name, I think creates the dilemma that the Fifth Amendment largely tries to avoid. And that's the issue that was before the court this week.
Mm-hmm. This was, as I understand it, a misdemeanor, and Mr. Heibel was, when he was convicted, assessed a $250 fine.
That's right.
Yes, and you know, it's an interesting thing because just recently I faced a situation in which the police were called to my house for having a loud party, but there was never, ever a party. And when they showed up to my door, they said that they were calling on me as a result of a complaint. And when I refused to give my name, they started calling for backup. And they were telling me that they would not leave unless I divulged my name. And if in fact I had nothing to worry about, why would I worry about giving my name and so on and so forth? I'm sure you could imagine the rest.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what was very interesting to me. And even a complaint that wasn't justifiable in my mind. And when they showed up, there was not absolutely anyone in the house but myself. So I found it interesting that they kind of had cornered me into giving them my name, even though I felt I should not have.
Okay.
So, but thanks for your time.
Okay, Bill, thanks for
thank
the
you.
Phone call. And Mark Rotenberg, we thank you for your time today as well.
Thank you.
Mark Rotenberg, president of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. He spoke with us on the phone from his office here in Washington. When we come back from a break, we're going to switch our focus and talk about the internal documents on interrogation tactics that the Bush administration has just released to the public. That was last evening. That in order to counter the perception, as they feared it was going to be widespread, that somehow the president or the administration had authorized the use of torture. We'll see what we found out from looking at those documents and whether this puts the case to rest. A lot of people think not. If you'd like to join that conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.